And during some of the toughest times, I have a little piece of paper in my wallet that I keep all the time, even to this moment, of different things that mean to me, different sayings that mean a lot to me, things that I strive for, recognizing my responsibility to give back.
Reoccurring mantra I got into in college where I would just say, I'm going to break the mold.
2 days after my second injury, my dad flew out to Indiana and we drove home, went right up to my room, slept for a day, and then I woke up the next morning, I spray painted my wall, no quitting me. I remember, you know, there is no quitting me and I won't give up.
The number one thing you gotta remember is you're transferring energy. And whatever energy you got is the energy the viewers are gonna have.
You are listening to Intentional Performers with Brian Levinson, where we talk with experts of craft about their journey and what they have intentionally done to be their best self. As we talk with them, the hope is that we uncover intentional gems that you can use in your life. Now, let's kick it over to Brian to introduce this week's guest.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Intentional Performers Podcast. I am Brian Levinson, excited to have you with us today for another incredible episode. But before we get to today's guest, I'd like to share a bit about myself. So my day job is that I work as an executive coach and a mental performance coach. And I founded a company called Strong Skills. And at Strong Skills, our team is on a mission to change how the world thinks about soft skills. See, we are facilitators and coaches, and we truly believe that labeling competencies like leadership, teamwork, and communication as soft devalues and minimizes the importance of these skills. And one of the strong skills that we teach is what we call shift your mind. And the teachings come from my book, which came out in October of 2020. If you enjoyed today's conversation or any of our past guests, then know you're going to love the book. You can head over to Amazon or anywhere books are sold to purchase. And you can even listen to the audiobook via Audible. Thanks to all of you who have already purchased, and I've been truly overwhelmed by the response the book has gotten so far. Lastly, if you enjoyed today's conversation or any of our previous episodes, we'd love it if you went over to iTunes and wrote us a review. It really helps us expand our reach for the podcast. Thanks to all of you who have already done so, and let's continue to share these intentional performers with the world. Now to today's guest. Steve Claggett is the Director of Learning and Development with the Baltimore Ravens. And prior to arriving with the Ravens, he's had quite a journey and quite an experience and a pretty incredible resume, which includes serving as a White House Fellow, where he got to interact with the President of the United States and a lot of other dignitaries and people that are making decisions that influence our daily lives. He also worked within the U.S. Navy, rising to becoming a lieutenant commander, where he also worked with the Navy SEAL teams. And so we talk about mission, we talk about values in today's conversation, and we talk about what is applicable and what may not be when it comes from the military to the sports world. We also talk about politics in today's conversation. As I mentioned, he got an up-close and personal seat to witness the quote-unquote, as I call it in today's conversation, the circus that is our political landscape. And so we touch on that a little bit today. He also was a Pat Tillman Scholar, so he certainly has been recognized and acknowledged as somebody who is constantly learning, growing, and is mission-driven. He is someone who I think cares about the work that he's doing and is looking to make an impact, certainly within the NFL, but beyond the NFL and in the community that he helps serve in Baltimore. So this is a rich conversation where we really zoom in and think about character and how you assess for character and how you think about putting together the best possible team to compete, to contend, and ultimately to win. So Steve is a competitor himself, but he's also someone who's constantly learning and trying to grow himself. So I know you're going to love learning with Steve today as I did. So here is Steve Claggett. Steve, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Really excited to dive deep with you. Our last call, I think, could have been its own podcast. So hopefully we'll live up to that conversation. And you've had such a variety of roles now, certainly with the SEAL teams and the Navy, being a White House fellow, and then with your role now working with the Baltimore Ravens. So maybe give us a sense of the similarities that you've experienced across those different sectors and also some of the differences as we get into it.
Sure. And Brian, thanks for having me on. This is wonderful. Wonderful talking to you again. I think, you know, I spent 13 years in the SEAL teams, a year in the year as a White House fellow, and I got my business school degree from UVA. And so I come into this job as so much of a generalist, right? And I think for a while, I was always worried about this because we live, you know, as David Epstein wrote, right? We live in such a specialized world, but here we are, here I am, trying to figure out how to use all these experiences and all of these things I've read to apply to my job. And I think when I look back on, you know, just when I look at the NFL at large, and I see just similarities with the political world that I sat through for a year. And that world was, it was such an interesting time because the White House Fellowship is a one-year nonpartisan assignment. So I joined in fall 2020, right? COVID, the last 6 months of the Trump administration, the election, January 6th, the first 6 months of the Biden administration. So being a nonpartisan observer in that hyperpartisan time was really just enlightening. And when I kind of look at
Steve, let's just go right there. Enlightening in what way?
So I think, well, that experience, so again, the White House Fellowship, just for framework, there's three main things with it. One, the 14 of us that did it were assigned to senior people in the administration. So each of us has a day job where we see the federal government from that perspective. We're also had the opportunity to talk to amazing speakers, a lot of former presidents. We met with Elon Musk, congressmen, senators, you name it, people in the business world and the political world. And then you just have an opportunity with, you know, for me, 13 other great human beings just to bounce ideas off of. So here we were in this hyperpartisan time talking about everything from elections to COVID, race relations. And I was able to have conversations with these people in just a very safe and non-threatening way. And so we learned from each other during that whole time. You know, when January 6th happens and then a week and a half later, you know, we're there with Vice President Pence, you know, talking to him on his way out the day before he leaves, just and then seeing the Biden administration come in. And I think that framework for me was both encouraging but disheartening, right? You see some people in the federal government that are really great people on both sides of the aisle that are doing good work for, you know, true reasons. And then, and normally you don't hear a lot about those people. And then you see kind of the ones who are doing it for pride. They're doing it for, you know, values that I don't believe in. And, you know, those people we do hear a lot from. But I walked away from it just, you know, I think the power of that year means more now than it did then. Just so I can, like, I experienced that year. I've made some great friendships and, you know, hopefully I can apply some of what I learned into my job now.
So we'll talk about the similarities and differences, but I want to stay on politics for a minute. I've had similar experiences. There are people that I've met that are in our House of Representatives that are super impressive and are servant leaders. And that phrase gets put out a lot. Like, they are there to serve this country. But the circus, like, I'm so turned off by the circus of it and the politics of politics. And I've become almost skeptical of, like, is that arena just an arena that is not favorable to the best of our humanity? And I don't know. I've seen the best, and then I've also seen how it's a political game and that it's a animal, and it is there are things and decisions that have to get made that are really complicated. So I don't know if you have any other perspective. Obviously, I'm from this area, so I get exposure to it at times. You know, I've been inside the Capitol walls, I've spent time there, and it's an inspiring place. I mean, it is the most powerful place in the world. And then I walk out of there and I'm like, I don't know about living this every day. There's lying, there's backstabbing, there's, like, games that are played that have big time consequences. So I don't know. I'm it's you're hitting me at an interesting place where I'm wondering about this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think our primary system and the financial incentives that go into this business do us a lot of service, right? I mean, I remember I was talking to a congresswoman, wonderful congresswoman, and just about running and what she's endured and the thought of running. And she's like, well, you know, you need to raise about $2 million. And this is maybe a couple of years ago, so it's probably increased since then. And so, okay, what type of people can raise $2 million? And it's not for Congress, for people in Congress, it's not just raising it initially, they're running for re-election. And I have a lot of, what I'd like to see is you do see some congressmen now who are saying, hey, I did my time. I did 6 years of service. I poured everything I had into it. I'm going to go back in the private sector. And I think that kind of that Thomas Jefferson founding fathers model of going from the private sector to the public sector and back in, I really like that. I think we should have more politicians like that.
And you mentioned the SEAL teams. So obviously we've had on a lot of SEALs. I think I told you that the first time we talked, and SEALs are fascinating. And there is this sort of doctrine and this code of sort of keeping a low profile. And yet we see SEALs often not keep a low profile. Mm-hmm. We've got SEALs. Like, I remember there was a time I was spending a lot of time with three different SEALs that were all buddies. They were so different. And yet I think SEALs get painted as like one brush of similar people. There's like a type. And then there's this word that just sticks out, which is teams. And this notion of, no, you're part of the SEAL teams. Maybe that's the thread we focus on. Can you just talk about the importance of team in your experience working in the Navy?
Yeah, I mean, just to start, you know, when SEALs are kind of talking to one another, we don't say, hey, he's a SEAL. We say he's a team guy, right? So if I'm talking to a buddy, I'm saying, hey, yeah, he's a team guy over here, right? And so that's how we, you know, label people. And the thing about the SEAL teams is, I mean, and when you go to BUDS, which is selection course, there's so many mantras, so many sayings. One of the ones, it's right there on the wall when you walk in on the grinder. It says it pays to be a winner, right? Everything's a competition. Whether it's an individual competition, a competition with your swim buddy, a competition with your boat crew, everything's a competition. But part of the competition is also who you are as a teammate, right? And I think that's important for any organization. Like, you can be a high, and I believe in like being in a hyper-competitive organization. That's part of the reason why I like the NFL. It's a very competitive organization. You get the best of the best. But you need to make sure that that competition also reinforces selflessness. And whether it's in just the day-to-day interactions that we have, it's written into our ethos, right? Which of course, you know, people stray from, but that element of selflessness, duty, honor, country, that's important. And I think that's what separates people.
As you think about your work with the Ravens in learning and development and really helping create a culture that's intentional, how do you bring out a competitive spirit while also having that selfless collaboration? How do you merge those two when thinking about what you're trying to accomplish in the NFL?
Well, internally, right, there's two things in my job. One, I help with the selection and development internally of staff. And so one of the things we focus on is we want people who are competitive. We want people who, you know, are passionate, curious, but we also want good teammates, right? And so that's kind of in our internal process. And then when we're building a team, you know, you kind of get into what character traits we're looking for. And we spent a lot of time digging into this when I first joined the Ravens in 2020. But when it comes down to it, you want people who are passionate. You want people who believe into the, I guess you'd say, the performance mindset of which you've written about. And at the end of the day, especially in certain positions, you want selfless individuals, right? There are certain positions in football that are a little bit more individualistic. And then there are certain positions where it's a team within the team, right? You're looking at your O-line or D-line. Like, that group, that cohesion, them working together, that's important, that's selflessness. So looking at each position differently, I think, is something we strive for.
What qualities make someone a great teammate?
You know, I think about accountability. A lot of that word gets thrown a lot. And for me, accountability comes in phases. One, you have to be accountable to yourself, right? You can't make excuses. You own your mistakes. You learn from your mistakes. But really, the next step in accountability is taking accountability for your individual team. Right. So in the SEAL reference would be, you're accountable for your own actions. But then if your platoon or your fire team or your troop messes up, that's now your fault. That's, you're accountable for that too. And then you go in a bigger sense. Now, if your team messes up, that's, you know, although you may not have contributed that directly, you have to take ownership in that. And so in the football sense, you know, what we're trying to do is we want people to be accountable absolutely for themselves. And then the next step, we hopefully we get people who they're accountable for their position group, and then, or they're accountable for their side of the football, and then they're accountable for the team. Right. So when you hear people in the press conferences talking about, and you know, there's a team loss, and whether or not they contributed to that or not, they might have had a great game, but people who take ownership of that. And I think we've done a good job of bringing in leaders that do that.
You mentioned, you know, the team's element of being on the SEAL teams, and there's always analogies that exist in the sports world where we're going out to battle, we're going to do X, Y, and Z. Beyond the obvious difference that one is a mission that involves, you know, maybe killing a terrorist or like, you know, defending democracy and like real life and death, and the other is a game and an entertainment. Beyond like the obvious that they're not similar in that way, what are the differences that exist when you're talking about our military and we're talking about a pro football team? How are they different?
Well, the incentives are different, right? You look at human behavior, you look at the incentives. I think when they allow the incentives in the military, it's not for pay. I mean, nobody's joining for pay. People are joining for different reasons. Maybe it's adrenaline. Maybe it's because they want to be part of a team. Maybe this is really the mission. They believe in America, but the incentives are different. I think in the NFL, a lot of people love the game. Some people love it for money. Some people love it for fame. I'm fine with those. As long as you can still be a good teammate and still be the best version of yourself. So the incentives are different. I think when I think back, I think one of the similarities is both units exist some ways to inspire others, right? When you think about the military and you think about NFL, in a lot of ways, I think a lot of, you know, the population thinks favorably of them because they're doing something that, you know, they couldn't do, they don't want to do, but they still feel inspired to that. So when there's a, you know, great performance on a Sunday, or you have a military unit does a great job, I mean, that is hopefully inspirational to others.
One of the things I didn't realize because I didn't play football as a kid is the segregation that occurs on a football team. Offense, defense, there's almost multiple teams within it. Obviously, you have special teams. You mentioned that positional traits are important and that maybe we're looking for something over here that wouldn't work as well over there. When you're thinking about selection and putting the right people around, how do you create an environment that is cohesive, even given the nature of football, where you often have offense spending a lot of time with offense and defense spending a lot of time with defense? How do you bridge that gap to make sure you have a cohesive unit?
One of the things that, you know, I think Sam Walker has written about this, but the essence of a glue guy, like when I think about the best, and, you know, one of the cool things about being in the SEAL teams is I wasn't part of just one team. You know, you're constantly moving around. I was in charge of different units. I moved to different units. So there's like in my 13 years, I was part of maybe 8 or 9, 10 different teams. And so you have, you know, more cohesive teams than others. And within those more cohesive teams, you have a guy who might not be a leader, but he's the person who brings everybody together, right? He's the person when the training's over is joking around with guys in a fun way. He's bringing people together. And I think in a locker room, having glue people, especially, you know, in certain positions, right? O-line specifically, like having a glue guy on the O-line who can bring that unit together. And they might not be the best talented player. You have somebody who just gets that group together where they start becoming a cohesive unit. And it's the skills involved with that. It's so much of that is just who they are as a person, right? They don't have to necessarily be gregarious. They just have to be authentically themselves and caring about other individuals in a way beyond football. Right. So when football's over, the training's over, they still care about these other people. You know, what's going on in their personal life? Can we get together and, you know, get a meal together? Those sort of events.
Were you a glue guy?
At times, yes. At times, no. No, I think when I look back in my career, I think about like times I could have been more of a glue guy. I kind of get focused too much on being a leader and not a glue guy. And that is difficult because as a leader, there's that constant balance between the mission and the men. And, you know, ultimately, your responsibility is the mission, especially as a leader, right? Your responsibility is the mission. You can't do it at the disregard of the men, right? And so you have to strike that balance. And I think I could have done a better job in my career in focusing more on the men on some of the units I was with.
That resonates with me because ever since I can remember as a young kid, I liked being the leader. And at times I was probably cancerous or toxic. And maybe that's going too far and being too harsh. But definitely if I thought we should go left and the coach thought we should go right, I was gonna voice my opinion. And I wasn't often scared to do it. And it is an interesting change, which is, are you focused on leading or are you focused on the men and making sure that the men and the mission are connected? Glue even suggests like connectedness, togetherness. It's a really cool word. I don't think I was. I think I was often willing to rock the boat, willing to like challenge, willing to ask for more creativity and innovate. And I think I still am. Like, I think I still am willing to put myself out there, but it's not always for the sake of the glue.
Yeah, and I think that's fine, right? I mean, I think when you're talking about building a team, right, you can't just have a bunch of people that want to just focus on the welfare of the team. You need people who get people outside of their comfort zones and push the team in different directions. And I mean, one of the best compliments I've received recently was somebody who said, "Hey, you did a great job of getting me outside my comfort zone." Like that things like that, I think, is what I enjoy doing too. And so I think leaders have to do that in some regard.
Do you miss being the one executing? Do you miss like the missions and actually going out and performing, or do you see your work now as still doing that in some capacity?
I think one of the misconceptions of SEAL teams is that it's simply flying in helicopters in the night going after terrorists. And although like there were, operations I did and there were deployments that I did that was our main focus, a lot of my focus was on more complex and strategic problems when it might not have been the capture kill operation that everybody thinks about. And so I think I really enjoyed at the end of the day leading teams and solving complex problems, right? There's no right way to do it. Nobody's really done this before in some situations, but leading teams and solving complex problems like that, I enjoy it. I enjoy that.
What are some mental models that help you solve complex problems or make decisions?
Well, it's interesting when we first came in, when I first came into the Ravens in 2020 through a SkillBridge internship, and we're trying to figure out this character, right? What it means to be a Raven. One of the things I brought in, so I brought in, of course, some of the experience I had in the SEAL teams with regard to looking for certain quality traits. And then I also brought in something that I was learning in business school at the time, which was the Toyota 5Y model, right? Dig, dig, dig. And so I think when we were looking at figuring out our character selection process, we spent, I think in total, maybe 3 months focused on this problem. And I think maybe half of that time was just defining the problem. Like really digging in to try to figure out what we do. And so often we just jump and get to the solutions without just digging in on the problems, figuring out, okay, when we say this, what does it mean? And what does that look like? And then how do we find that? And right, just digging and digging and digging. And I think that helped us set the framework for our process.
I live in Bethesda, Maryland. I am a few miles from the Washington, D.C. border. My family's from here. My parents grew up where I live now. We grew up big Washington football fans. We'll just call it that. That's the name we'll use for this podcast. You, some other people I know at the Ravens. I know a lot of people at the Ravens, a lot of smart people, are like, hey, come on over to our side, right? And by the way, a lot of people have. And there are a lot of people that I live nearby that love the Ravens. The reason I'm bringing this up is not because of my childhood or my fandom. The reason I'm bringing it up is since the Ravens have come to town, they have been consistently a strong football program. I mean, really strong, consistently strong. And I know that because as a fan of the other team, it's been like the opposite. And so the question becomes, there is a culture that's been established from the Ed Reeds or the Ray Lewis's, right? Like these things have been built, Ozzie, right? The GM, like this stuff has been going on for a while. My question is, how do you blend the culture, the values, the traditions that have been built that have worked for so many years while still being innovative and still not resting on your laurels and still finding new ways to create when there's been a way, like, what does it mean to be a raven? Like, there's been a history. You know what it is. You've seen it. How do we do that while still innovating and making sure you're not resting on your laurels?
Well, I think it starts from the top. I mean, I think the owner is very much an owner that believes in what are the resources you need to get the job done? Here they are. I expect things from you, and I'm going to get out of the way a little bit. And then it goes down to Eric DaCosta. And Eric DaCosta, you know, he grew up in football, scout for so many years, and he's been in this organization from the beginning. And you would think maybe he's just a scout, but Eric's probably best attribute is his curiosity. He's an avid reader of not just football related stuff. In fact, most of it's probably not related to football. And so for him, he's just got a sense of curiosity where he's always trying to improve and he's always trying to find slight improvements in the organization. So when you have like my boss promoting curiosity, that trickles down, right? So the expectation is everybody is going to be somewhat curious and everybody's going to try to come up with innovative ways. And some of these things might not go anywhere. But the fact that we have a culture of curiosity is helpful.
Hmm. Is that also, does that trickle down on the players? Would you describe your players as being curious?
I think so. I mean, I know so. I think a lot of them, you know, a lot of them are really good players in college, right? And so they're used to having certain expectations and certain ideas, and they come in and they'll have ideas, but yet we've done a good job of having them work with the coaches on that. And I think Coach Harbaugh does a good job of listening, not just to the players, but to his coordinators too, right? So Coach Harbaugh, special teams background, secondary background, but he's not an X's and O's guy. He's not necessarily getting the weeds of what the defensive coordinator, offensive coordinator, special team coordinator is doing. And so he's empowering them. And I think those coordinators empowering their position coaches, and those position coaches are listening to their players. And so I think there's a lot of collaboration and curiosity in the football side of the house.
You mentioned getting out of the way, and it's interesting. You talk about Harbaugh, you talk about the general manager, DaCosta, you talk about Shoddy. It sounds like there is like, hey, we are going to learn. We're going to innovate. We're going to create. We're also going to hire really smart people. And then that's a phrase that we don't often talk about in leadership. We're going to get out of the way.
Right.
Why use that phrase?
Well, I think it starts, well, as we talk about effective leadership in this space, I think we have to start from kind of a framework of high-performing team, right? Which I would define as it involves a rigorous selection process. And then the individuals that compromise the team are either experts or considered to be the best in their craft, right? So when you have a team like that, which I had in the SEAL teams and you have here, I would define effective leadership as working with a team on establishing a vision, giving them clear roles and responsibilities, the resources they need to get the job done, and then getting out of the way, right? And it requires a mindset shift where the leader says, you no longer work for me, I work for you, right? And if you have that mindset shift of like, these people, they don't work for me, I work for them. And I had those leaders when I was in the SEAL teams. And that creates like an amazing system. And if you think of like teams and leadership and broadly those two kind of models, one is you have a kind of a controlling leader who talks about, this is what I want you to do, this is when I want you to do it, this is how I want to do it. A lot of times that'll lead to, you know, firewalls to shared understanding. Normally that leader gets stressed out because they find themselves correcting the work of the people beneath them. And they're not spending the time on focusing on the second, third order effects or contingencies that might happen. In the other model, you have a leader that doesn't focus on control, they just focus on guardrails. And their communication isn't what, when, and how, it's why. This is why I want you to do that. And then that leader, because they're not spending as much time focusing on cleaning up the work of the people beneath them, they're now free to think about these contingencies. What happens if this happened? What happens if COVID starts canceling the college season? How are we gonna like change the way the game's changing? So, and when you have a situation like that, now people feel bought in, people feel like they're an integral part of the system and the culture improves. So I think broadly speaking, when I think about teams and leadership, I view it through those lenses.
When you think about your head coach of a football team, a general manager of a football team, decision-making is so, so key and critical. And whether you're, you know, on SEAL teams and there's decisions that need to be made there, or, you know, we call it the war room when you're drafting players, or Harbaugh deciding to go for two or not, right? Like there's constantly decisions that get made by leaders. And you can be as curious as you want to be. At the end of the day, if you're a leader, you also need to have conviction on the decision you're making in that moment. What have you observed, witnessed from the leaders you've been around what goes into great decision-making?
So I'll talk a little bit about my time, the teams and then in draft rooms. I don't get involved in kind of football game strategy or anything like that. But when we're doing mission planning on it with an operation, a lot of times you're briefing a boss who has maybe like 10 more years of experience than you. They know things that you otherwise just haven't experienced. And when you're having those kind of meetings, the best ones are the ones where it feels like a safe space. And the leader who you're briefing doesn't necessarily point out your flaws, but they ask questions where you identify those flaws. And at the end of the table, at the end of the day, when you're talking about these things and a decision has to be made, ideally you want a culture of disagree and commit, right? Where people feel safe that they can disagree, but at the end of the day, when the boss makes a decision, you commit. So in a draft room setting, we create a safe space where people can voice their opinions, where people can feel heard, and then they might disagree. But then when Eric says, okay, great, we're going to place him here on our draft board, or we're going to take him here at this spot, his decision is now our decision, right? All that disagreement doesn't matter. We committed to this person, this player. Our job is now to get behind that.
One of the things that I've found to be fascinating with our military in general is debriefs. And I think the military is elite from my conversations with a variety of people in the military on debriefing and making sure that they're learning from what transpired. Let's just use the NFL draft because we're recording this in March. You just got back from the combine. My 8-year-old son is watching the combine and, you know, guy runs a 4.2 140 and him and his buddies are watching and they're yelling and screaming. I'm like, this is that exciting to you guys? Yeah. Don't you want to watch the basketball game that's on? But it just goes to show of how important the NFL draft is to the success of an NFL team. It is massive. What have you seen as far as debriefs? So you might have this plan and you know exactly what you want to do. And then something comes up and there's an opportunity to move back or move up, or this guy gets taken or this guy's available. What's the debrief process look like post-draft to make sure that, all right, what did we do well? Where could we have improved? And if you want to also give me some insight about what you witnessed in the military from a debrief standpoint, maybe they do it worse. Maybe that's an assumption on my part, but let's just talk about debriefing and what you've witnessed in your time.
Well, I'll talk about the military aspect of it. And, you know, after action reviews, AARs, it's ingrained into our culture so much so that it isn't just doing AARs after a mission. It's doing AARs after a training operation. And so you know, you're doing a long training operation, you get back at 2 a.m. and everybody comes in the team room and you sit down and you go through from the start to finish. Okay, how did we plan this? How did we execute it through all phases of the operation? What could we have done better? You capture it, you record it, and then you move on, right? Whatever like immediate lessons you need to change, you implement them. As kind of the wars were winding down and the real world repetitions decreased, what we had to do from a training perspective was try to simulate that training as much as possible and then still fill in those AAR moments. And so one of the things we would do with, you know, officers just drill down into like what their role might look like on an operation, you know, work it through the team that they'd be working through. And then immediately afterwards kind of debrief, what could we have done better? Even a slight improvement. And that's just like anything else. You have to build those repetitions. So if that time comes, we get caught up in the middle of the night and you have to execute those things. You might not have the real world repetitions, but you at least have the practice repetitions. So, and then if you go a step further, one of the things we started doing was before action reviews, right? Or pre-mortems. And so if you're thinking about something or looking at a certain operation, you'll go into it saying, okay, what did we do similar to this? And what did we learn from that? And then now let's look at our current plan and attack it as much as possible. What could go wrong? What thing would happen that would just kill this plan? And so let's strengthen up our plan through that action too. And sometimes that's done by an element outside of your unit, because when you're kind of planning and you're locked into this plan, you have come to the conclusion it's the best plan. Sometimes it's beneficial to get somebody adjacent to your unit to start providing counterpoints to your plan.
Yeah. You mentioned David Epstein at the beginning of this conversation, and he's who introduced us. And he has obviously written about the power of range and being a generalist and having people in the room with diverse opinions so that we can avoid some of our blind spots. Character is a word that you've used. I have been hired by pro teams to interview players at different combines and create assessments on their character. And I'm actually having someone come on the podcast soon who I interviewed at the NBA combine, and I have a profile on him, and I can see that probably my profile is pretty off. And so it's fascinating to like look at it and see. And just like there's an inexact science to drafting a quarterback, and because they produced in college, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to produce in the professional level. In your work around this, what have you learned about assessing for character, and how do you maybe think about it differently today than how you thought about it 10 years ago or when you got interested in this world of personality assessments or character assessment or whatever it is you want to call it?
Well, I think the first step goes into defining that word, right? Defining that word character. And I think that's the most important piece, because if you don't have a clear definition of what that word means, and if you even break down that word into five or six principles, it's going to be really difficult to have objective conversations. And then it's going to be almost impossible to develop metrics that you can kind of feed into any sort of model. So the first step is just focusing on what that means. And then what I've learned over the last couple of years is the value of, you know, a diverse perspectives, not just from snapshots of who has known that person at certain points in their time, but also when you're interviewing somebody, having people from different backgrounds looking at that person in a different lens than you do. And so we'll begin interviewing players. And when we interview players, like sometimes I'll interview a player by myself, but I often enjoy doing it with a couple other people. Like I said, I played 1 year junior varsity football. So I'm looking at this from a completely different perspective. My experiences are wildly different than almost anybody in the scouting department. So having somebody maybe with more football background, or maybe from this part of the world, or played this position, having those different perspectives on that player and then looking through our differences in opinion helps. It helps kind of create a clearer picture. And at the end of the day, right? I mean, you're looking at 21, 22-year-olds. You're going to the NBA. You're even going younger than that. And so I always often think about, I mean, these people, just like I did, they'll change. They'll change to some degree. So there is an elasticity with these things.
Yeah, especially in the NBA, I would interview kids that were 18 and then another one that was 23.
Right.
Big difference for those of you, like go back to the time when you're 18 and you enter, let's just say you went to college or wherever you were going, and then post, like it is a massive, massive difference. And I think that gets lost sometimes as we're assessing for talent in the sports world. And it's an interesting piece. For me, one of the things I realized when I did that work was I actually didn't get that much fulfillment out of the assessment. So I would interview players, I'd create profiles, and it was a nice addition to the work that I did. But at the core of who I am and my purpose, I love helping people get from where they are to where they want to go. I love the development piece.
Right.
For you, where do you find purpose? Where is the place that you really feel lit up and most alive?
I think it goes back to solving complex problems, working on complex things, learning individually, seeing people grow, seeing people become better leaders, seeing organizations improve from their culture perspective. I think just like finding ways to improve the culture day in and day out. I know that's something that is difficult, and it's very difficult to even put a number towards, but just the morale, when you can improve the morale and you can improve the culture organization, like it just makes coming to work every day better. And that's difficult to do. It's just a bunch of micro behaviors along the way, along with the strategy of how you're going to do it, but it's difficult but rewarding.
When we chatted last time, you told me the story of how you even joined the Ravens.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because Mission Barbecue plays like this role in our neck of the woods. They've got wonderful barbecue, first of all, just really good barbecue. When I think of a culture and a company that has a culture and knows exactly who they are and what they stand for, you know, you walk into a Mission Barbecue, you see the American flag, you see patriotism, you see military, you see, I think, police officers, parking, you know, they get parking spots. Like, there is a clear sense of who they are from a Mission Barbecue standpoint. So I don't know how much you want to get into your journey to working in football, but it might provide a lens into how you think about things. And then once we get out of that, maybe we'll come back to culture and what you think it is when it comes to the Ravens.
Did I tell you the story about what happened like 7 years ago in Seattle?
I don't remember.
Before, so the backstory here is, halfway through my career in the teams, we were training up near Seattle, and a guy in our platoon knew the kicker for the Seahawks at the time. And this, I think, was the year after the Seahawks won the Super Bowl. So we got invited over to training camp. We spoke to the team. Then I went to one of Dan Quinn's defensive meetings. And after the meeting, I was wandering around trying to look for, I can't remember what, but this guy grabs me in the hallway and he says, "Hey, you one of the SEALs that's in town?" I said, "Yeah." He goes, "Hey, you got a second?" I was like, "Yeah, sure." And we went into his office and we spent the next 45 minutes or so talking about grit. Right. "Hey, what's grit? Like, how do you find it? What do you look for? How much does it matter? Like, what are some of the character traits of these, like, building these teams?" And we're just talking, and I didn't know who this guy was. He told me his name was John. And then as I was leaving, I saw on his door, it said John Schneider, general manager. Right. And it's funny, you know, that was when that kind of a seed was planted in my head, as far as maybe there's something to my experiences and what he's dealing with as a general manager. And so then fast forward, I think 7 years, when I was getting out of the military, the Department of Defense has this amazing program called SkillBridge, which essentially allowed almost any veteran to work for any company. At the time, it was for 6 months. So I was free labor for 6 months. And then when I was getting out, which was the toughest decision I ever made, was leaving the SEAL teams. When I made the decision to get out, I knew I was going to kind of move back home to Maryland. And so I was, you know, trying to find an organization where their values aligned with mine. The idea of working in sports, again, that seed was planted after talking to John. So through, you know, Bill Krause, the owner of Mission Barbecue, does so much work for veterans. And, you know, we had some mutual contacts. I met with Bill, and he introduced somebody who introduced me to Eric. And then when I got down to meeting with Eric one day, I just told him a little bit more detail about what I did and how I thought I could help him. And then I told him, I could work for free for 6 months. And I think, you know, I was like, "Oh, free labor." And so that was my kind of foothold into this industry. And then shortly after that, like, COVID hit, and then I got selected to be a White House fellow. So that's when I took a year off. And then I came back to the Ravens in the fall of 21.
Welcome to the world of sports, where free labor is where a lot of people start their career, or some version of free labor.
That's a good buzzword, free.
We won't go into that. Decision to leave the teams. You mentioned that was one of the toughest decisions you made. Yeah. Ultimately, what led to your decision to move on?
I think it was primarily just because I wanted to challenge myself in a different setting. I mean, that's part of the reason why I joined the SEAL teams, was to challenge myself, or at least, you know, apply for it. But I wanted to kind of challenge myself in a different setting. I wanted a little bit more stability in my life. The moving, the deployments, the time away from home. When I kind of forecasted out the next 7-10 years, I thought about how much time I'd be gone, what jobs I might have. And so when I was getting out, I was looking at a bunch of different companies in the DC area, Baltimore area, and then just happened to find the Ravens, and their values aligned with mine. And here we are. But yeah.
As we're recording this, you've got a big American flag over your shoulders. And I think about this word loyalty, and how people are loyal to the country that serve in our military. And you mentioned earlier, they're not doing it for fame or money. They're doing it for country. Most of the time, there's all kinds of reasons why people serve. The word loyalty in the business of sport is under fire, especially at the professional level. And I think if you talk to people who work in the business of sport, the players certainly, they'll say, yeah, the days of like loyalty have passed. How do you think about the word loyalty and how that plays a role or not in your work at an NFL team?
It's definitely different. I mean, I was in sports 10, 15 years ago, but yes, you hear the stories about the difference in loyalty. And part of that is just because of the CBA, right? And the player mobility, which has been, you know, great for the players. When I think of loyalty, I think sometimes loyalty is attached to like this bigger goal, right? America, freedom, liberty. And sometimes loyalty is just your teammates, right? And for me, I think when I was thinking like, why am I doing this SEALs job? A lot of it's just because like, I want to be loyal to my brothers, right? And yes, there's the values of, you know, what we were doing, but for me, that's where a lot of my loyalty laid. And I think in sports, you create dynamics where people can feel that same loyalty to their brothers, their teammates, their organization. That can go a long way.
It's interesting. It's almost like every year there should be a reset on building that loyalty amongst each other.
Yeah.
And building those relationships every single year and almost starting fresh. And not to assume just because we have a Raven logo that we truly are loyal to each other. There's going to be new people here. There's never, you don't, no NFL team ever returns the exact same roster. It doesn't happen. And so, like, what goes into building relationships? It tends to be trust, respect, communication. And then those can lead to an outcome of loyalty, almost like loyalty is an outcome that is earned when the communication, the trust, and respect are there. And I wonder, as I'm thinking about it, it's like we've got our culture. That's our bedrock. That's who we are as Ravens. And then every year we are going to work our asses off to build a loyal, cohesive, connected group that is going to care deeply about each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that will be between the walls. But we've got this, you said it earlier, there's still a purpose. There's still a community element to this. There still isn't, we're here to inspire others. And so it's like each year we need to recreate the loyalty piece and never forget that we're also connected to the people outside this wall. And that we're playing for a city and that we represent a city and what is the city about and why does it matter and why should we care about not just us, but also the people at the hospital that we go visit or in the community at the soup kitchen or, you know, the people that are at our games. And so it's almost like an and, but I think sometimes we blur them together and it creates confusion for the athlete where it's like, they're not loyal to me. They just cut the guy next to me. Like they're loyal to the logo. Who am I loyal to? I think that's an interesting question for players to wrestle with.
Yeah. And I think you said it well, I mean, trust and communication, right? That's how you build that. Because at the end of the day, you know what's going to happen. The team is going to face some adversity. That's a given. Players are going to hit adversity. That's a given. You know it's going to happen. So building that loyalty internally is critical.
It reminds me a lot of, I've heard this about the FBI, that when you join the FBI, they take you to the Holocaust Museum in D.C. and they want you to remember that you're loyal to the country, not the president. And like in some ways, it's kind of similar. It's like, hey, you all need to be loyal to each other. That doesn't mean you still don't have a responsibility to our community. But at the end of the day, we need to be connected. We need to be in lockstep. We need to be in unison and in harmony. And if we're not, if there's leaks, then we're going to fall apart.
Yep.
And so I imagine there's actually some similarities there between like the macro and the micro. And there's almost this back and forth that needs to take place. And by the way, from the outside looking in, the Ravens seemingly do a really nice job of, you listen to their players, you listen to their staff, you listen to them interviewed, and there does seem to be connection. Is that because they're winning? I don't know. I think you would probably have a better sense of it than I would.
No, I think you're right. I mean, a lot of it just comes down to good, authentic, honest communication, right? And trust, like knowing that, you know, if Eric cuts somebody, he's doing it because he believes it's right, but it's not personable. It's not personal. And really caring about that person. Those are tough decisions to make.
As we were talking about earlier, it's, as you think about building the team, we talked about selection, but another part is also development. How do you all think about developing the people once they get into the facility? Like, you spend a lot of time on selection, but what does development look like from a learning standpoint and from your perspective? And it may even go beyond the players. Like, we're focusing on the players because that's maybe easiest, but what does development look like from a learning standpoint as far as the culture in Baltimore?
Well, so when a player comes here and they, we draft them or whatever, they come in here, we kind of then turn them over to the football coaching staff. We have a player development staff led by Jamil McLean. And we've got a great, you know, strength coach, nutritionist, physical trainers, and all of those people are trying to make that player the best version of themselves. You know, as rookies, a lot of that is just getting familiar with the NFL and this business. So there isn't much more development placed upon rookies. And as guys get into their second, third years and they kind of know the system, they know what's expected of them, they know where they are, that's when hopefully they'll start making those leaps, those, you know, those jumps into either being a better glue guy, becoming a better leader. And so I think, you know, where we are as a team, you got guys like Tyler Linderbaum, who are going to be stepping up into leadership positions. And then, you know, he's coming into his third year, right? And so when he was a rookie, he's just kind of thrown in the fire. He's a starter. Now, you know, he's looked upon as, you know, he's a Pro Bowler. Now he's going to step up as a leader this year. I'm really looking forward to that growth in him.
I've heard with teams who say, we don't really focus on captains. We want a team full of leaders.
Yeah.
Do you think it's important to label the roles of captain and identify the leaders, or is it better to say, hey, we want everybody to lead? How do you think about that from a team building standpoint?
Well, I think the Ravens are one of the only teams that don't assign captains. So we'll have game day captains, and Coach Harbaugh will pick those every week. And we have a leadership council of veterans who, you know, work with the head coaches on certain issues. But I think, you know, at the end of the day, Coach Harbaugh is the leader of the team, right? And the players are leaders too. And maybe they might not get a captain, but it's recognized that they step up in leadership roles, even if it's an informal role, like a glue guy. So I think that's unique in this organization. I think it was us and the Patriots might be the only two teams that didn't have captains. So I don't know where that stands with the Patriots now, but it's an interesting dynamic.
And we talk about money. So money does play a factor. I remember when I worked with a Division I football team and I would ask the guys, why do you play football? And the amount of them that said, take care of my family. Like, right. This is a physical, grueling, in some ways scary, sport for some. It's hard on the body. And so a lot of them, there is this financial incentive that's driving them. As you think of intrinsic motivation and extrinsic motivation and the value of each, how do you make sense of that? We talked about a little bit earlier, but how do you make sense of that when you're building a team? Because, like, let's use Ray Lewis as an example, because I think everyone else, like, that dude loved football. Like, there's not a, I don't think there's any question that Ray Lewis loved football. We watched Peyton Manning. Like, he loved football. He eats, breathes, sleeps football, which is great. They also were really good at what they did. But I would imagine when you get your roster and you look at it, there are going to be people there that are not as passionate or obsessed or in love with the game, but they can still really help you. How do you think about intrinsic motivation and extrinsic motivation as it leads to elite performance?
So this is something I think my opinion on has changed over the years, but I think intrinsic motivation isn't as important as external motivation, right? If a player is motivated by money to support his family, you know, I think that's great if that player day in, day out plays like a Raven, right? So even though that may not align with, I think, what some of the expectations we have for these players, what their motivation should be, if their outcome is passion, at the same time caring for their teammates, caring for the success of the program, I don't care. I think that's great. So I wonder sometimes if we are too hard on people for their honesty in that regard. Because, I mean, I'll tell you another thing. As I've been, you know, meeting some of these players the last couple of years, most of them are incredibly inspiring. Like, I know there's a lot of, you know, sports athletes out there that might, you know, appear like divas, or they like, oh, they're millionaires. They got everything figured out. There's a lot of players who won't make generational wealth. There's a lot of players who come from nothing and have overcome so much in their life to get to this moment. And you just can't help but root for them. So I feel the majority of the players I'll meet, and even in, you know, at the combine, and coming into this draft process, there's a lot of inspiring people out there that you just really hope make it.
I think we hit on this earlier, but I want to make sure I'm crystal clear on it before we close. High character. What does that mean?
So I think in our definition, you know, we came up with a handful of principles. And for us, high character means being a lead at each of those principles, right? And so for certain positions, it might matter to be more elite in this principle than others. But for us, we've come up with a system that can kind of put a number next to it, which helps make decisions. So a lot of it will just come down to selflessness, passion, accountability. And of course, the off-field behavior is important as well. So all of those things go into somebody we would call a high-character person, player.
And when is it worth it to take a shot on a low-character person?
I'd probably deflect that to Eric. You know, I think that's one of the things that people don't realize is how difficult these GM jobs are. I mean, you look at a certain player, he's got maybe 10 scouts who have an assessment of who it is. I have my assessment of who the character is. Coach will have an assessment. Other coaches will have an opinion. The media have an opinion, right? And at the end of the day, the analytics department will have an opinion. And at the end of the day, Eric's the one who's trying to sort through it all and make the decision that's best for the club.
That piece to me is also fascinating because I know when I interviewed people, they can be great at interviewing. And yeah. Then they do the due diligence and they're like, wait a second, that person said X, but our due diligence says Y. And to your point earlier, someone you might say is this way. And then 3 years from now, they're actually like way different, or they were in an environment that didn't nurture them. And now they're in a different environment and a different culture. Mm-hmm. And it's so tricky to figure all of that out. And what I always used to tell the teams that I would help interview four is like, this is one piece in multiple buckets. Like never select a guy just because of their interview, just like you wouldn't select them just because they're 40 time. Like right. That makes no sense to me. Or just because the analytics says they're good or the analytics says they're bad. Right. It's like, these are all buckets and put it all into a bucket. And then you're going to give yourself the best chance to be right. And you're going to be wrong. So like it's part of it is sometimes like predicting future performance of human beings is really, really difficult. Mm-hmm. And a lot of time and energy is being spent on that. We've focused on the draft with a lot of this conversation, but I'm also curious about how you think about it from a free agency standpoint, or if there are trade opportunities, how do you all do that on the fly? How do you assess from a character standpoint or a cultural alignment standpoint when you may not get to interview them or you may not get to give them a personality assessment? How do you do it? Like you're about to enter free agency and those people will have a massive impact and influence on your team going forward. Any thought on how to do it when you're not necessarily starting from zero?
Well, it's much more difficult, right? Because if the last time you did an interview with this person, you did a character assessment, this person was 6 years ago and they went to this system. It's really, it is difficult. I think the thing about free agency is we've done our homework and on the guys, and we're continuing those conversations this week. And, you know, that is something that Eric will look into as far as what is their fit as a player and what is their fit in their locker room. And so it is much more difficult. But if he makes a mistake on the fit, the thing about Eric is you'll see in his past decisions is he'll move on from it. He's made decisions in the past where he brought in players and it didn't fit, so he got rid of them. And you move on to the next one. But it is more difficult. It is more difficult because you can't do as much in-depth research. Like for the college system, you know, we'll talk to their coaches in college and stuff like that, but it's not like you're going to go to the Eagles and talk to the position coach or whatever team you're talking to. So it's more difficult.
We've talked a lot about how the Ravens think about things and your way. You were just at the combine. What mistakes do organizations make? And it doesn't even have to be NFL. We can zoom out and go into other industries or politics or military. When you look around and you see from a cultural standpoint or a learning and development standpoint that they're not where they maybe could be, what do you think gets in the way?
It's tough because I've been with another team, right? And I hate to, you know, I grew up in the DC area too. So I hate to talk about what other teams might be doing, but I think one of our biggest reasons for success is we know who we are. You know, we know what type of process we have. We know how to put the player through the process. And so we have a good foundation of knowing who we are. And then while also, like we talked about earlier, remaining curious about how we can improve on that. So I wonder if, you know, other teams, organizations truly know not only who they are, but what is the most effective process to then put this potential candidate through to make sure we're reducing our probability. Because at the end of the day, these are probability bets. right? There's no 100% lock in any draft class. These are probabilities. And so reducing that risk is just like a mission. And like when you're planning an operation, you go into a mission, there's no 100% chance of success. Your job is just to drill down to the potential contingencies that might happen, mitigate that as best as possible, come to the fight with the best team possible, and, you know, see what happens and then learn from it.
And that's a great place for us to stop. Steve, I was on your LinkedIn profile earlier today and I saw something about farming for hunger. So I don't know if that's something we want to shine a spotlight on. But I'll certainly give you the opportunity to do that, and anywhere else where people can connect with you, learn with you, anything else you want to promote or shine a light on, now is a good time to just share.
Thank you. So Farm for Hunger is great. It's a program in Southern Maryland where you take, returning citizens and put them, you know, they raise produce that goes into the food banks in the local Southern Maryland area. It's run by Bernie Fowler. It's a great organization. I think two other things that I'd highlight to people, maybe more, a little bit more near and dear to my heart. One would be the Taylor Ann Foundation, which last two summers ago, I lost my 7-year-old niece to a vicious brain cancer. My sister established the foundation, hoping to create a cure for this cancer. And so that's a great organization that my sister set up. And I'd say, like, broadly speaking, maybe this ties in everything we talked about today, but there's, you know, hundreds of thousands of different organizations out there to help veterans. And most of them are great. But if you want to find one thing to help the most veterans, it's finding them meaningful employment. And so when I think through how an organization can get better and I think about how what could help veterans, what I'd say is most veterans won't pursue a job that they did in the military. That's just the facts, right? So it's difficult for them to find an organization that aligns with their values and where they feel like they're an integral part of the team. I would hope that anybody listening to this has an opportunity to put veterans through their hiring process. And even though they might not have the direct skills, give them the chance to show themselves. Because like we talked about earlier, they'll provide a completely diverse set of experience and ways to problem solve than your team might have. And I'm asking that not from like patriotic reasons. I actually kind of get a little uncomfortable when people say like, thank you for your service. And if you want to know more about that, I'd say read Sebastian Younger's book, Tribe. But the point is, I think veterans can really be a value added to organizations, and helping them find meaningful employment is the best way to help them.
Yeah. And if I hear you, it's not necessarily out of charity. It's that they have a lot to offer. And yes, like you do with the Ravens. So, Steve, this has been a blast. I always try to get people to check out other podcast episodes we've had, including with David Epstein, who once again introduced the two of us. You can listen to all of those episodes at strongskills.co/podcast. I'm on LinkedIn at Brian Levinson, and then Twitter or X at Brian Levinson. Steve, look, I care about the purple. Like I'm connected to your organization in so many ways. And I think I just have some bitter Washingtonian resentment, jealousy, all of the emotions that can get in the way for a relationship are there for me when it comes to the Ravens. I mean, they came to town during my childhood and won really quickly. And I saw people start to wear their stuff. And, yep, you know, we talked about loyalty. Like, I have season tickets to the Washington Commanders. And I got to say, I went up to Baltimore last year and watched a game and sat there. And it's just an incredible environment, experience, community that they've built. And there's a lot of people that deserve a lot of credit, from players to front office to coaches to ownership. And they are a model for how to create a sustainable, consistent contender. And I think most sports organizations admire that and aspire to be that. And deep down inside, I'm cheering for you. I'm cheering for the other people that I know that might listen to this podcast. And I'm grateful that our paths crossed and that you're down the street, and hopefully we can continue to have these types of conversations in the future.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you for all the work you're doing, Brian. I mean, all the work you're doing with this podcast, your book, it's helped me in my personal life and it's helped me in my job. So thank you for all the work you're doing.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you for listening to Intentional Performers with Brian Levinson. Here is this week's episode gem.
We came up with a handful of principles. And for us, high character means being a lead at each of those principles. Right? And so those for certain positions, it might matter to be more elite in this principle than others. But for us, we've come up with a system that can kind of put a number next to it, which helps make decisions. So a lot of it will just come down to selflessness, passion, accountability. And of course, the off-field behavior is important as well. So all of those things go into somebody we would call a high-character person.